Well, good morning, friends and brethren. So very good to see you. Glad you've been able to make it today and that everybody has dug out after the snowy week. Glad that you're here. Glad that some who have been away from us for some time, sick, are able to get back. It's so good to see Bert and others that are able to be out. I want to tell you a little story here as we begin. I want you to think about what this little story says. A young boy and his classmate got involved in a fight at school. You can kind of picture how that would happen, can't you? Well, they were sent to the principal's office, and they knew they would receive punishment there. And as they were waiting, the nerves and fear growing worse and worse within them, they sat quietly and had to think about their actions. And as the boys both came to recognize the imminent punishment, they began to discuss what would happen to them when they walked through the principal's door. And then one boy said to the other, he said, "Well, I'm upset because the principal's going to call my daddy, and my daddy's going to hurt me when I get home." And the other boy said, "I'm upset because I know I've hurt my daddy." Well, what do you mean by that? And what is the point? The attitude and the thoughts of these two young boys were very different. Well, they'd experienced some of the same things. They had been in some kind of a ruckus together and had gotten in trouble, and here they are at the principal's office, and they knew they had some punishment to be faced. But the real part of the story is their attitude toward how their father would respond. One is concerned that his father is going to inflict more punishment. The other is concerned that he has hurt his father. What do you think about the conversation between these two boys? Is there a difference in the way they view the results of this situation? Yeah, I think so. And what would you say was the motivation behind the first boy's statement? And what about the second? What was his motivation? And the first boy was motivated by fear and maybe selfishness. He is afraid of what his father will do to him. And the second boy is motivated by respect for his father because he knows that he has disobeyed his father's will and that his father will be disappointed in him. So his response is different. He reacted because of an attitude that motivated an inward understanding and feeling. There was something different about that second boy and his reaction to this. And the real point is whether we can make some application. The story is just an illustration to help us think about what is our reaction to certain things. How do we respond? And when we think about the attitude of that second boy, is there some spiritual application that we can make? Now, someone might say, what spiritual word could we possibly attribute to the attitude of the second boy? And my thoughts come to godliness. We might wonder what the story has to do with godliness or how the word describes that attitude in one of the boys. But it'll help us to see how the Bible uses that term of godliness and how we can make some application to that. We start with godliness being defined. When we hear the word godliness, sometimes we say, well, that means like Christ-likeness. I get that, and that's a good point. We think of someone who is like God or who expresses or displays the qualities of God. We are not talking about His divine qualities. We don't have those. But the characteristics of God that man can also have. If a man is kind and loving and merciful and compassionate, we might consider him to be godly because God has those same attributes. But the word godliness goes somewhat deeper than that. W. E. Vine said this, defined godliness to mean, "To be devout denotes that piety which, characterized by a Godward attitude, does that which is well-pleasing to Him." That is, one who is concerned about what God thinks. One who is concerned about how God may view us or how we act. And so we want to have an attitude that is approved by God. Godliness has to do with the reverence and respect that we have toward God and how it shows itself in our actions. That our actions become very much God-focused. You know, we think again about the example of these boys. There is one boy who is concerned about the punishment that's coming to him. And there's another boy that is concerned that his action has hurt his father in some way or disappointed his father. I mean, the difference in the attitudes between the two are very different. We always knew that we had made an impact with our girls when they had done something that was wrong. And they were disciplined for that. And as they thought about that, they came back and they were upset. Not because they had been punished. That's what they were upset with at first. But they came back after a while and they were upset that we were disappointed in them. We knew that we had made a point. We knew that we had had an impact on them. Because they were concerned about what we thought. And I see that in the second boy in that story. And the point from that is when we think about godliness and our attitude toward God and how that affects our actions, we are the ones who should be concerned about what God thinks of our actions. That we care for God so much, we love Him so much that we in no way want to disappoint Him. That we do not want to fall short of having the characteristics that He has and the characteristics that He would want us to have. And if we fall short of that, it bothers us because we have disappointed God. We may want to, when we think about the respect that we should have for God, it may very much prompt us to live in a certain way. We respond with reverence to Him. Godliness is the attitude behind our actions, not the actions themselves. You see, if our reverence for God is not what it should be, then we can go about doing things that God wouldn't approve of, and it might not bother us because we don't have that attitude of reverence or respect for God. But if deep within us we want to be pleasing to God, we want to live and to do as He would want us to do because we love, we respect, we revere Him so much, it's that attitude that will affect what happens in our response to things, what happens on the outside. The right action can come sometimes from the wrong motivation. That doesn't make it right, and that doesn't make what's inside right. But what we are trying to do is adjust our attitude in such a way that what actions we take come from the right motivation inside. True godliness comes from a motivation that is deep within, and it causes our actions to be proper. When it would pain us to disappoint God because of disobedience, we are motivated by godliness. And when we choose to please God because we respect and we love and we want to honor Him, that is godliness. That's godliness in action. And so there are two inferences that we need to make when discussing the definition of godliness. True godliness requires proper understanding of who God is. We cannot live a godly life if we don't understand who God is and how He views godliness. If godliness is an attitude and mindset that respects and reveres God, then we have to know who God is. We have to know what God says in order to develop the right kind of reverence for Him. Many today consider themselves to be godly, but they do things that could never be pleasing to God. We need to be able to see the difference. And true godliness requires a genuine response to the knowledge that we have about God. If we learn about God and His will in our life, but then we do nothing about it, what good is that accomplished? We have to take our knowledge of Him and His will and we have to make application. We have to make that a part of who we are. We, We have to follow through. So knowledge alone is not going to make us a godly person. Well, we look at another point. Godliness developed. How do we develop godliness? We have a view, first, of what godliness is in the eyes of God. But how do we have that? How did we develop it? Well, again, we need to remember a couple of fundamental facts. We need to have a better understanding of who God is. Let's take our Bibles and go to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. You recall in the passage, the Apostle Paul is preaching in Athens, Greece. And he has come upon a city that is full of religious people. Because there are gods, there are idols that are everywhere. But they had no understanding at all of who Jehovah God was. Verse 22, beginning, Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and he said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, and I found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you." The point and the purpose of the apostle now is to tell them and to preach to them about Jehovah God, the God that they did not know. I mean, how much godliness can one have by worshiping a God you don't know? They had the altar there to the unknown God, but how much worship can you really do to a God you don't know? Well, soon they were to know about their unknown God because they were going to hear about Jehovah God. But as well, the Athenians, they worshiped many gods. They had an altar built so that they could worship every god that they had possibly forgotten. All of their gods were there. And yet, what did they know about their gods? Some would think probably very little. The word worship, as used in verse 23, comes from the same root word as godliness. It's an interesting thought. The Athenians were showing respect and reverence for a God whom they knew nothing about, the unknown God. They were religious people outwardly, but they were not truly godly. There's a difference. I want us to see that. I want us to think about that. That they were going through some actions. They were going through some motions. They had tried to cover all of the bases, even this unknown God. But how could they really worship? How could they show respect and reverence to a God they did not know? In reality, they couldn't. That was the apostle's point. And so what did Paul do? Well, he told them about the true God and His nature. Verse 24. "God, who made the world and everything in it, seeing He is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is He worshipped with men's hands as though He needed anything, seeing He gives to all life, breath, and all things. And He has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each one of us. For in Him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, 'For we are also His offspring.' Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone or something shaped by art and man's devising." So the teaching of the apostle was about Jehovah God, that He is the maker and creator of all things, that He does not need to be fashioned in some way by the hands of men, but God's power is so great that He is above all. God is the creator of the world and everything in it. This is the nature of God, the apostle was saying. The mind of men cannot possibly conceive all of the intricate complexity of life that God designed. And when we see the masterful intelligence that fills the world, we cannot help but stand in wonder and awe before God. When we think about who God is, His attributes, His power, His ability, His creative nature. When we think about these things, we stand in amazement before God. The God of heaven, He is real. He is powerful. He is eternal. And Jehovah God was not like all of the other gods that they worshipped, who had no power. They could do nothing. They were not even real. And yet, they worshipped them. How much reverence, how much respect would the Athenians have shown to this altar of the unknown God? A God of which they knew nothing at all. Here is a God that you know nothing about. You don't know His power. You don't know His will. You don't even know whether He exists or not. How much respect could you show for this God in your life? Not much. They were truly not showing godliness because they did not know much about God. You see, godliness has to be connected to our understanding of the one that we worship. And so they had an altar to the unknown God, but it really didn't mean much. Even if they bowed down before it, it was still empty, because they did not even know who or what that God represented. If we have no knowledge of Jehovah God, there can be no appearance of that respect in our lives. If we understand the power and greatness of Jehovah God, we will grow in godliness. We need to know God. When we think about godliness and we think about how that needs to be an attribute that leads and guides our lives, we have to understand that we cannot be godly if we do not know God. It's a fundamental point. And yet these Athenians had missed it completely. We have to better understand who God is. And another point with that is that we have to respond to the knowledge that we have gained about God. It's not just knowing Jehovah God, but now we have to do something with that knowledge. Let's turn to 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter chapter 1. We'll begin reading here at verse 2. Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of our God and of Jesus our Lord, as His divine power has given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness, through the knowledge of Him who has called us by glory and virtue, by which have been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises, that by these you may be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. Think about what the apostle is saying to these Christians. That there's been great change that has come upon their lives, that they have left the corruption that is in this world. They've been able to do so by the power of God. And the knowledge that they have gained of Jehovah God, His divine power that has given to us all things pertaining to life and godliness. If we want to stand right, if we want to be godly people, we have to have a knowledge of God, and we're going to have to do something with that knowledge. Verse 5. But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. So we affirm again that God has given us all things pertaining to life and godliness, and that has been given to us by a knowledge, through the knowledge of Him who has called us by glory and virtue. That we have to have an understanding not just of who God is, but the understanding that He wants us to have of His will. Here again we see a connection between knowledge and godliness, and a connection with the fact that we have to do something with all diligence, he says. to give all diligence, full attention, that we must respond to that knowledge that has been given. And given what we know about Christ and His offering of spiritual life, we should be motivated in such a way to be godly in His sight. To add, as the text would say, godliness to our lives. Godliness developed. It's not something that will just happen. It's something that we want to attain. It's something that we have to seek. It's something that we must want. That we want our lives to be changed by this knowledge that is given to us through the Lord and respond to it. And then we demonstrate that godliness. We've seen godliness defined. We've seen godliness developed. And we have to consider godliness demonstrated. Our godliness is demonstrated in life when we learn about God and when we respond to what we have learned. Returning to Titus. Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2. We begin at verse 11. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave Himself for us, that He might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for Himself His own special people zealous for good works. We notice again that God's grace teaches us that we should live right. That the knowledge that we have and we receive that comes from God is to affect us, is to change us some way, that we would live right, that we would live as He would desire us to live. This part would fit well with our last point, that God's grace helps us to learn more about God and it motivates us to respect and to revere Him. That God's grace shows us that we should deny ungodliness and live godly in the present age. That is, without Christ, that before receiving God's grace, we lived in ungodliness. That's the idea of no fear, no respect, no knowledge of Him. That's the opposite of where we should be. But to live in godliness, we have, by the grace of God, seen and come to understand who He is. We have accepted the knowledge that has been given and offered to us through His Son. And we have done something with that. It's with diligence that we have taken on godliness. It's with diligence that we work to change our lives in such a way that we are driven to have the very characteristics of the One who has blessed us so much. Godliness. The idea of taking on the attributes and the character of God. That we become more like Him. And that thoughts and decisions that we make in life are based upon His will. And if we choose to not follow Him, if there's a part of us that is humble, if there's a part of us that desires to be His people, when we fail to do His will, it hurts us. Because we know we have disappointed Him. Godliness will drive us to a relationship closer to God. Godliness will demand that we change our lives to be more like Him. Godliness will demand that we become less and less like the world every day, but that we take on His nature. We take on His being. And it's demonstrated, even as Paul says, looking for the glorious appearing of Jesus, zealous for good works, as we read just a moment ago. I mean, we are looking forward to the return of Christ. Because all of the hope we have in this life is pointed toward Him, eternity. And we should be zealous for good works because we want to take on the character of God and please Him. And our motivation is just that. We do not want to disappoint the one who has offered such grace, the one who has directed us by His knowledge, the one who has given us the ability to respond to His will. By His grace, it produces godliness, which is demonstrated in our lives. It changes us. Peter describes what's going to happen when God destroys the world. In 2 Peter chapter 3, I'm convinced that Peter was writing this to the Christians long ago to help to encourage their faith and to lift them up, that they would not be deceived and pulled away by the abundance of false teachers and false apostles in the day. And he's telling them, you know, hold on, because there is going to come a day when all of this is going to be sorted out. In 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Quite a graphic view, really, isn't it? I mean, the description of what's going to happen in the end. We don't know when judgment will be, but we know what it will. But we know what it will be. And judgment will bring about the destruction of everything. And Peter is trying to make sure that these brethren are ready. And he says, therefore, we go on. Therefore, verse 11, seeing then that all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy godliness, conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens, being on fire, will be dissolved and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Peter is making an appeal to these brethren to live their lives in holy conduct and godliness. Well, of course. In what other way could they live and be counted as God's people? What other way could they live and not have fear of that day when the earth is no more? And so you think about what Peter is telling them, the lives that he's encouraging them to live in godliness, and we think about our understanding of God's will. We think about our understanding of godliness and a character that is following the attitude of God. And you couple that with the knowledge that has been received, then all the more we are compelled to respond, to live as God would want us to live. Motivated to live in godliness, a demonstration of that attitude toward God. We don't want to disappoint Him. If our attitude is so fixed on Him that we want to live with Him in this life and in eternity, we do not want to disappoint God. We want our character to be that which He would want it to be. We want to be more like Him. Godliness is the attitude then behind our actions in life. Godliness has to be the motivator. And once we develop the proper knowledge of God, and once we revere and we respect God for who He is, then we will be motivated to manifest that respect in our lives. And the actions that we do and the characteristics that we show, that's not what makes us godly. It's the attitude behind those things. You see, we can go about doing all of the things that make us look religious. We might do all of the right things in the eyes of man and even in the eyes of our brethren. But if we do all the right things, but it's not because we are motivated by godliness, well, we've still missed the mark. We've missed the point. We can go through all the right motions, but if it's not for the purpose of serving and pleasing God, we've still missed the mark. Godliness has got to be the motivator. godliness, that internal desire and drive to be as God would want us to be, to please Him, to have and take on the attributes of God. That's godliness. And if we set that in our heart and we make that a part of who we are, what we do in life will come natural and will be that which is pleasing to God. Thank you for listening so well this morning. We'll take just this moment to encourage any who might need to respond to the gospel of Christ. There are Christians here, many of us are Christians who from time to time have to just stop and look at ourselves and think, are we the people that God would expect us to be? We struggle. Yes, all of us do from time to time. But what do we do when we struggle? When we sin, as we will, do we hate that? Do we disappoint ourselves even sometimes? I do. Thankfully, we have a means to have those sins taken away and removed by the blood of Jesus. That even as Christians, when we fall short of the will of God, when godliness has not been in us as it should be, we can still make it our goal. And when we struggle with sin, as we repent of our sin and pray forgiveness, God forgives. If you're not a child of God, but you are understanding what you need to do to stand right before Him, becoming a baptized believer, we're hoping that you'll respond even today. Would you come as we stand and sing?